Hello. Welcome back. All right. Onward. Let's talk about some nervous system tools, and kind of that dance between expansion and contraction. So, as you can imagine, I work with a lot of people who are in chronic states of dysregulation and or hypoarousal. People with big windows of tolerance don't work with someone like me, although I am very much wanting to expand into working with more people who do have bigger windows of tolerances. Windows of tolerance, not window of tolerances. Windows of tolerance. I would like to work with more people like that because yeah, that just feels like the way that my work is like naturally going to evolve. I don't want to help people in crises all the time. I want to work with people who feel confident in their ability to get through crises and like want to be in more expansive, embodied, authentic states, and not just like, baby beginners, which none of you are. You wouldn't be here. So, I think this bridges those two things. Like, this isn't basic work, but it's also not like some of the more expansive stuff that I would like to be doing in the future. But it's like a perfect bridge between the two, I think. So, since nervous system information and language and tools are really trendy right now, people are often coming into my space wanting tools. And they want to know, like, what tools do I need? What's going to make me feel better? How can I regulate my nervous system? Give me the tools. But because this is part of a feel without fear, if you aren't feeling it, you aren't healing it. And what we feel or are afraid to feel, is outside of our window of tolerance. So, like, if we're afraid to feel something, then it's because we believe that if I feel it, I can't handle it for whatever reason. Nervous system tools are the least useful if you're using them to bypass or avoid the feelings. So what a lot of people experience is dysregulation is constant somatic symptoms, right? Like constant sort of tension and palpitations, knot in the throat, ugh, in the guts, like tension in the neck and shoulders, low back, like clenching in the pelvic floor, digestive issues, like all of that. So much of what people experience as nervous system dysregulation is really uncomfortable sensations. And sometimes, especially for like anxiety symptoms or whatever, certain tools like breath work or tapping or whatever can be really, really useful for like turning the volume down on that anxiety to be able to be more present with it and feel it. But what a lot of people do, myself included at one time, was it's like as soon as you found a new tool to use and you used it and it worked, then it's like, oh, good. I found something that I can use so that I don't have to feel that anymore. Now I know what to do if I feel that again. I'll just use that tool. And then it becomes a really sneaky way of bypassing what you're actually feeling because you're never just pausing to be with it first. You're just regulating it away with a tool. And because it's described as a nervous system tool and you're into nervous system regulation, it never crosses your mind that, like, I wonder if I'm missing something. I wonder if I'm using this tool appropriately, because if you're using tools to stop feeling things, you're using them inappropriately. Nervous system work is all about being in our bodies, present with what's happening. We're reconnecting with sensation and emotion that we've avoided because they were scary and uncomfortable, or because our culture has told us that they're bad or wrong. Of course, we need to know how to self-soothe. Like, that's a really important skill to have. But so often the work stops once we found the thing that works, right? Whatever the thing is that makes us feel other than how we presently feel, especially if what's actually happening is really uncomfortable and we want to avoid it, we'll look for anything. We'll buy anything. We'll spend any amount of money for that thing that promises us that outcome because that's what we're seeking as a salvation fantasy. So if you're always reaching for a nervous system tool when you feel discomfort, you might be getting through that moment of dysregulation, but you're not expanding your window of tolerance to be able to hold anymore. You're just getting through it. You're experiencing relief, but not resolution. The work of healing trauma and our nervous systems and widening our windows of tolerance requires being able to feel uncomfortable things. All of these are uncomfortable things. We have to be able to feel all of those things. It doesn't require us to be in utter misery and discomfort all the time, though, because as we talked about in the last workshop, pleasure and play are also really necessary parts of this. So I'm not talking about being in the trenches all the time, but you do need to be able to be in the trenches some of the time. So if we use our nervous system tools as a means of avoiding discomfort, our expansion, our ability to hold more, our ability to embody more of our authenticity will come to a halt. If you don't increase the size of the vessel through expansion, pleasure and play are part of increasing the size of the container, right? You don't increase the size of the container and you just use tools as a means of avoiding discomfort, the container doesn't get any bigger. So you're just going to go in circles. So I'm not telling you to stop using your tools, but I would like to invite you to add a step in your process if you're going to use nervous system tools. And so before you reach for your breath work or your tapping or your yoga or your legs up the wall or whatever your tool is, before you reach for it, just pause and feel first. That's all I'm asking you to do. 30 seconds, a minute, 5 minutes, like whatever you can handle, just pause and feel it first. If you find it difficult or impossible to be present with your feelings and you need nervous system tools frequently to get you throughout the day, like your window of tolerance is really small. You're actually going to benefit more from widening your window of tolerance by letting yourself feel some of that than you will from using nervous system tools to stay in a smaller window. So remember when I said the line between dysregulation and hyper and hypoarousal is blurry and different from person to person. I cannot give you a prescriptive statement to be like, here's when you know you're dysregulated. Here's when you know when you're hyper or hypoaroused. Here's when you should use a tool. Here's when you shouldn't use a tool. I cannot tell you that. You have to commit to finding that line for yourself and honoring it because it's going to change sometimes. You have to commit to the process of feeling to be able to determine, oh, I'm a little dysregulated or I'm fucking hyper aroused. Only you know what you can handle and when you need to bring a tool in. And the more you practice this, the more you'll be able to handle and the less you'll need to bring the tools in. But I can recommend when it might be necessary to use a tool and when you can stretch yourself a little bit to expand and be with discomfort. So, if you are way blown out of your window of tolerance, I would recommend a tool. When you purchased Feel Without Fear, you got for free my toolkit called Nervous System CPR. If you haven't used it yet, please look into it. It is a collection of 9 short, small file size videos that you can download to your phone. David came up with the cute little phrase, you can have Lindsay Lockett in your pocket. And yeah, you can literally download these to your phone. And if you're like having an oh shit nervous system moment, you can pull out your phone and be like, oh, here's these like 9 videos. I'm just going to pick one, right? Like it's right there. So if you're hyper or hypo aroused, that's when I recommend that you reach for a tool. Okay. If you're just slightly dysregulated, slightly annoyed, a little irritated, a little anxious, like whatever, sit with it. Just pause, wait, feel it. That is a perfect moment that the volume on a feeling is low enough that it should be pretty tolerable for you to notice. And the faster you can get into the practice of noticing when you have minor dysregulation, minor discomfort, if you can get into the practice of noticing that and honoring that and being present and pausing for that, you can avoid that escalating into hyper and hypoarousal. So, it actually is going to serve you to not use a tool when you're dysregulated and just pause and be with it. Because, as you all have experienced throughout Feel Without Fear, sometimes, often, just being present with a feeling and observing it curiously is enough to turn the volume down. No tool needed. Have you all observed that yet? Have you all felt that? Okay, yay. You may not need a tool at all. So, you can. I think you know the difference. Hopefully, you know the difference. If you accidentally use a tool when you're just dysregulated, it's not the end of the world. Like, don't worry, you'll get dysregulated again. You can try again, right? Okay. Earlier, we talked about Newton's third law. For every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. So for every expansion, there's a contraction. For every contraction, there's expansion. If you blow out your window of tolerance, like real big, your equal and opposite reaction may be that it shrinks down even smaller after that. Like that has happened to me multiple times where I thought I was doing pretty good and I decided to try some crazy, expansive, risky thing. And it was like too much, too fast, too soon. And the spank I got after that was I went back to like my capacity being less than what it was before for a while until I like regained some energy and some like trust in myself and recovered. So if you blow that window of tolerance out, just know that contraction is going to be a harder spank. Okay. Your expansion, your contraction will be proportionate to each other. So it's not necessary at all to blow out your window of tolerance because you're wanting to face and heal triggers. Some of our triggers right now might be way too much, way outside your window of tolerance to handle. I do not recommend that you try to force yourself to face those. Trust that maybe that you're not ready for that yet, and that doesn't mean anything about you. And maybe if and when the time comes and you have chosen to do so, you can try to face that trigger and call in support if you need or help or resources or whatever. But it's not necessary in the name of healing. It is not necessary to make yourself miserable. You are going to have much better results with small, slow, gentle titration and intentional exposure to stress over time. Because gentleness and consistent practice also makes contraction less severe, and it still allows you to expand slowly and sustainably. It is also necessary to have tools that can bring you back to safety and regulation quickly when you're blown out of your window of tolerance. However, you just don't need or want to regulate away every moment of dysregulation, because if we do, we aren't widening our windows of tolerance. And the whole point of embodying authenticity is to expand to be able to hold the authentic self, which is an expansive being. So with time and practice and consistency, you're eventually going to be able to tolerate stressors that were once intolerable to you, and you will know how to return to the lovely safety of your comfort zone when you need to. So I just want to give you an example. Early 2019 was like the worst of the worst of the worst for me. This was my rock bottom. Everything that's inside the square is what I could tolerate. It was pretty, my existence was pretty small. My world was pretty small. I really could not handle a whole lot. I couldn't handle working. I couldn't handle not having a routine. I couldn't handle traveling or driving. Those were big fuck no's. I wasn't able to cook or clean. Like I was, my world was so small. So I tried to make a graphic to show you all the things that are now within my window of tolerance, but the text was too tiny and you couldn't read it. So I can hold so much more now. And even if I go through a period of contraction now, I can still hold more during a contraction now than I could during a contraction 4 years ago, right? Like the contraction isn't as big, or it's not as hard. It doesn't spank as hard. I'm not really sure. I just know I can hold more now. I've expanded to hold more. It's amazing. Do I ever get outside my window of tolerance now? Yes, but it's pretty rare. It's pretty uncommon for me to have like a big, big trigger. I can't even remember the last time I had a big reaction. But I've cultivated a really intimate relationship with my body, and I have a lot of confidence in my ability to return to the safety I've created within myself. I'm also just really sensitive to my body, and I'm never not paying attention to what I'm sensing and feeling. And so I usually notice the minor dysregulation before it has a chance to like blow up into something else. So then I can do whatever I need to do to take care of myself and like not let it get crazy. But remember, the goal is not never get dysregulated. That's not the goal. It's just appropriate dysregulation, appropriate and proportionate. Dysregulation isn't bad. It's not a sign of personal failure or weakness. It's normal. It's healthy when it is to an appropriate threat, right? So here are some more realistic goals than never get dysregulated. Okay. This is much more realistic. If you can have more flexibility in your nervous system, so you get activated, it's an appropriate threat, and once the threat is resolved, your nervous system naturally comes back to safety. The ability to return to safety after a threat is over is also part of flexibility. It's being able to access different states, but also being able to return to safety quickly instead of the threat just like persisting on in your body even long after it's passed. It's also a great goal to cultivate more capacity in your nervous system. So you can hold more stress without added dysregulation, and you can also hold more expansion. You need a bigger container to hold things like joy and risk and pleasure. More resiliency. You can bounce back more quickly after stressful events. It's a realistic goal to have more awareness of your body's sensation so that you can discern when dysregulation is becoming hyper or hypoarousal. It can be helpful to have more awareness of the voice in your head and the ego stories that make meaning about feelings. When we are outside our window of tolerances, we know because the reaction is often big. Big anger, big anxiety, big urge to run, big freeze, big shutdown. I need to change this slide because it filled without fear didn't used to be a whole thing. But I want you to think back to Untriggered, the second workshop. As a review, here is the diagram of the brain. So the amygdala and the hippocampus, which all of this is part of our limbic brain. So the amygdala, which is the fear center of the brain, and the hippocampus work together, and they are what declares threat. The hypothalamus then sends a message down the brainstem and tells whatever branch of the nervous system to activate in whatever way it determines is going to be the most successful way to resolve the threat and survive. So the signal is either going to go down a dorsal vagal pathway, or it's going to go down a ventral vagal pathway, or it's going to go down a sympathetic pathway, or it might go down two pathways, in which case you'd have a combined state. Okay. So this response, this amygdala to hippocampus to hypothalamus to nervous system response to stress and stimulus happens in real time with any sort of trauma. And the exact same series of events happens when we're hyper or hypo aroused. Exactly the same. Because our brains don't know the difference between a trauma that's happening in real time and a trigger, right? The body is experiencing them as the same experience. It doesn't know the difference. So that's why the same series of events happens in the survival brain. So when hypo or hyper aroused, the limbic brain has sensed a threat level that can plunge us into undesirable behaviors like lashing out in anger, self-medicating with substances, and withdrawing from life. Using words like affirmations and mantra do not work on the limbic brain. The limbic brain doesn't speak English, French, Chinese, Spanish, or any other language. The limbic brain also doesn't keep linear time. So when a threat, real or perceived, past or present, is detected, it only takes 75 milliseconds for the amygdala and the limbic brain to send survival signals throughout the body. Okay. This is four times faster than you can blink your eye. However, the prefrontal cortex, the part of your brain that allows you to reason, analyze, and make grounded, thought-out decisions, takes at least 350 milliseconds to perceive and evaluate the threat if the limbic brain hasn't totally taken over. Because remember, when we're in a threat, we lose access to some part of the prefrontal cortex. So if you're not totally in like an amygdala hijack and you still have some of your access to your prefrontal cortex, you're still getting messages of survival and threat going through your body faster than you're able to logic your way through it. So our big reactions are the result of a decision being made for us by our survival brains. Big hyper hypoarousal reactions are always unconscious. They're never on purpose. They always happen faster than we can think about them. 75 milliseconds is not a very long time. It does not give you much time to like reason and analyze and use your prefrontal cortex, does it? No, because survival needs to happen faster than that. Of course, our bodies are wise to be that fast. But we also hurt ourselves and others when we're in that reactive place of not being able to access our ability to be aware and present and logic our way through something. So, do we just react and then apologize later? If we don't have conscious control over our reactions, what are we supposed to do? There are always going to be situations where big reactions are unavoidable. And you don't want to avoid an unconscious survival response if it's what's going to actually save your life, right? Like, although it's probably unlikely to happen, it could still happen. And you would be grateful that your body has retained the evolutionary knowledge to spring into action to make you do sudden and unconscious things that end up saving your life, even if you don't know what you're actually doing, right? Like, you will be grateful if that ever happens. But that rarely happens now. So usually when we have those big reactions, it's to a threat that's not real, or it's disproportionate to what the reaction is. Those aren't the times I'm talking about. When your body knows what it's doing and it takes over, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about being so in tune and connected with your body that you are able to notice when you're dysregulated and before you drift into like big reaction, big shutdown territory. So I would like for you, if you can, think back to a time when you had a big anger reaction. Maybe you screamed at someone or hit someone. Maybe you don't remember because it was such a big reaction that you weren't really present. If you can play that movie in your head and study yourself, was there a point at any time in that interaction, was there a point when you could feel irritation or annoyance, anger shift into like aggression and rage? And what did that feel like? Maybe you can't remember. Maybe it was happening so fast that you can't play that in your head. Maybe you can't even call up a time when you had a really big anger reaction. But maybe if you have one in the future, you'll remember this and you can think back and go, okay, well, that was a really big reaction. When did it shift? When did I go from being dysregulated, angry, to hyper aroused, raging? When did that shift happen? What did I feel? Was it like a sudden rush of heat to my face? Did my hands clench into fists? Did I have an uncontrollable urge to just like tear somebody down? Now, can you think back to a time when you had maybe a big collapse reaction? If you play that movie in your head and kind of study yourself, or if you can't bring up something or recall something like that, you might have one in the future and maybe you'll remember this. So was there a point when you felt like a little bit of shame, but then it got bigger and bigger and bigger and like out of control shame? Like, or did you like do something that was like so risky and expansive and it was like so traumatizing to you that you felt the collapse afterwards, where like you just had to rest or you just had to sleep? Maybe your body was like so heavy you couldn't move or you couldn't speak. If you can't call up a time like that, it's okay. No matter what happened, no matter what the events were that were in front of you when this happened, you can probably remember some cues that your body was starting to become in like major distress. And if you don't, that's okay. You're not doing something wrong. It's really normal to not be able to recall the specifics of a traumatic or triggering event, because if you lose access to your prefrontal cortex, like that's where that shit is stored, you know? That's why you don't have explicit memory of those things. So the main way to stay aware of what's going on in your body so that you know what your line is between dysregulation and hyper or hypoarousal is embodiment, being in your body. When you are so in your body that you are aware of the little shifts and feelings and sensations, you can learn and recognize in real time what your signs of distress are that tell you that you're getting close to getting outside your window of tolerance. You're getting close. You're pushing the edge. Staying in your body during a conflict, emergency, uncomfortable situation, or feeling takes practice. One thing I recommend is, as a first step toward embodiment during discomfort, is to create some sort of touch point with your body. So what I mean by a touch point is like, if you're in a conflict with someone and you know that during conflict, you often dissociate and like go out of your body because maybe that makes you fawn, or maybe the dissociation like cuts off your ability to access your words or to speak clearly or think clearly. If you can somehow remind yourself to stay in your body. So like placing a hand on your thigh, right? You're just like sitting with your hand in your lap, but you're staying conscious of the sensation of your hand on your thigh. Like I'm talking to you, we're having this uncomfortable conversation. Maybe I'm setting a boundary or maybe I'm telling you how I feel, but in an effort to stay in my body during this, I'm keeping my hands here, right? And I'm like maintaining awareness of this sensation as a way of staying in my body. Another one, you can be in the middle of talking to someone or listening to someone, and you can just, I can talk to you and I can do a little body scan at the same time. And notice I was holding a lot of tension in my diaphragm. Oh, that feels good. Notice where you're holding tension. Maybe you find it in your jaw, your pelvic floor, sucking in your stomach. Somebody can be talking to you and you can do this and still listen to what they're saying. And if you find places of tension, you can release them and that will send a signal to your body that, hey, this is actually safer than you're acting right now. Another way that you can stay embodied is by maintaining a conscious presence with your breath. Notice if your breath is shallow and irregular, and if it is, slow it down and deepen it. That will also send messages of safety to your body, even if you're in a really uncomfortable situation. So I talked earlier about recognizing potential signs of distress. So when you might be slipping from dysregulation into hyper or hypoarousal. So, obviously this isn't an exhaustive list. There could be more, but these are just some examples. So like if you're in your body and you notice, oh, my hands are in fists. I wonder what that's about. Or maybe your eyes are frozen and empty. If you get fidgety, if you lose focus, if you get a sudden rush of heat or flushing, or you suddenly feel very angry, if you feel anxious, if you're having a panic attack, if you notice yourself blaming other people, if you get a sudden headache or other symptom, all of these can be signs that your body is like, hey, back off, like slow down, it's getting scary. So if you can start paying attention to what it feels like when you're triggered, and you might feel differently depending on the trigger or the perceived threat that's in front of you, it is your responsibility to know what your window of tolerance is and when you're outside of it, because no one else can know this for you. So start being in your body, pay attention, study yourself, be curious, get familiar with your signs of distress. Now we'll talk about widening your window. So, how we build capacity, resiliency, and flexibility in our nervous systems is the same way that you build muscle strength when you go to the gym and lift. You stress out the muscle by lifting something slightly heavier than you're used to. So, if 20 pounds is easy for 8 reps, maybe you add stress by doing more reps, or maybe you add weight and do less reps, right? But either way, you're adding a little bit more stress to stress out the muscle. And then you rest the muscle and you allow it to recover. You don't walk into the gym and deadlift 350 pounds if you haven't trained for that yet. You would really hurt yourself and you probably would not succeed in it at all. And your nervous system may not be able to face your big things right now. Those triggers are like the 350 pounds that you can't lift without hurting yourself, right? And there's no reason to re-traumatize yourself to do any of this work whatsoever. So this is why finding your edge is important. You stress your nervous system out intentionally to the edge and you come back to safety. And you consistently repeat the stress safety cycle to build resiliency, flexibility, and capacity in your nervous system. If you are currently going through a stressful time in your life, then this next section does not apply to you because I'm about to talk about intentional stressors. You can use the stress that you're going through in your life right now to widen your window of tolerance without adding anything else. Okay. If you're going through a relatively chill time in your life right now, then this is the perfect time to introduce some intentional stressors. Creating more resiliency, flexibility, and capacity in your nervous system does not happen if you're always in safety, just like the muscle is not built by lifting nothing. So here is kind of our cycle that we go in. We start from a place of safety. We then are choosing or consenting to whatever the stress is. If you're already in the stress, can you consciously now choose and consent to go through it, especially if you've been resisting and there's nothing you can do about it? Then we expose ourselves to the stressor, to something uncomfortable. We titrate the amount that we're exposing ourselves to. And then we always come back to a place of safety. So that's kind of the process. So beginning from this sovereign place of safety, sovereign is just as important as the word safety, because sovereign says, I am my authority in this. I trust myself. I decide what is best for me. I don't outsource this to somebody else. I'm choosing. I'm allowed to take as much time as I need. I commit to the process. I establish safety in my body by practicing. I choose this. Choice and consent, the second step of the cycle, means I know what I'm choosing and why I'm choosing it. I understand the potential risks and benefits. I'm making an informed decision to expose myself to this intentional stressor for the purposes of increasing my stress tolerance. I'm taking full responsibility for myself, and I am consenting to doing this. Intentional exposure means I am doing this for the purpose of increasing my stress tolerance and widening my window of tolerance. I am choosing this intentional stressor. I use my agency to decide when I begin and end this practice. And I'm going to share you three intentional stressors that you can use to practice: cold exposure, breath work, and an acupressure mat. And then finally, titration means I am slowly and gently increasing my exposure to this stressor. I'm committing to not intentionally blowing myself out of my window of tolerance. I trust that I will be okay, even if I do blow myself out of my window of tolerance. And I understand that consistent exposure to small stressors over time is preferable to trying to navigate a stressor I'm not yet ready for. So here's our examples of intentional stressors. Now, some of these, like an acupressure mat, I've totally gone through super stressful times in my life and still use an acupressure mat. And it was like great, like so great. It's a pain tolerance thing. So it's like, if that doesn't feel like something you're able to tolerate, fine. Certain types of breath work can be really helpful during really stressful times. Other types of breath work are intentionally stressful. I'm giving you an intentionally stressful kind of breath work. But if you're already going through a really hard, stressful, overwhelming time in your life, then you don't need to add more stress, right? Just start going through your stress more consciously. So the common theme with each of these intentional stressors is they give you opportunities to relax around discomfort and surrender to what is happening so that your body, mind, spirit can experience stress and discomfort and realize, hey, this is not fun, but I'm okay. You might even be surprised to discover that with consistent practice, you even begin to love and crave these intentional stressors. That's what cold plunges were like for me in 2020. Man, I craved them. So here's our first stressor. This is an acupressure mat. It's what I'm laying on there. Does anyone already have an acupressure mat or know what they are? Do you like it? Yeah? Okay. Yay. Good. I'm so glad you already have it. So the stressor on this one is pain. It is best to use with no shirt on, but for the purposes of this picture, I have a shirt on. For me, the first couple of minutes are the hardest, and they provide a really great opportunity to relax around pain. Please do not use an acupressure mat if you have any kind of skin inflammation, if you have unregulated high blood pressure, if you have thin skin due to Ehlers-Danlos or diabetes or something else, if you have a blood coagulation issue, if you have an open wound on your back, or if you have a fever or an acute illness. Cold plunges is going to be our second intentional stressor. This is a stressor of cold. It is the most effective at 60 degrees Fahrenheit or less. I don't know what that is in Celsius, but it's probably really cold. Anybody ever been in less than 60 degree water? Yeah, it's pretty freaking cold, isn't it? Have you been in less than 50 degree water? Have you been in less than 45 degree water? No. That's the coldest I've ever done for like 30 seconds. Like, I'm out. And the colder the water is, the more uncomfortable. If you've ever done that before, you know, like 58 degrees and your freaking labia start going numb. It's a really weird sensation. So we want to titrate, right? I don't want you to start at 45 degrees. If you're choosing cold as your intentional stressor, actually probably be best to start at like 70 degrees and then slowly work your way down. So here's why I love cold plunges. They are an easy opportunity to practice complete presence and somatic and cognitive awareness. They will get you in a zone like nothing else. It's a great sovereignty practice. For those of us who have complex trauma that involves like not having a choice, like abuse we didn't have a choice in, or our parents' divorce that we didn't have a choice in, or abandonment we didn't have a choice in, like if we have a lot of charge around our personal choice, then cold plunges can be a great way to like repattern the fact that like you get to choose when you get in, you choose how long you stay, and you choose when you get out. So it's like, I get to choose if I want to be in this discomfort or not, versus when you were a child, you didn't get to choose. You just had to survive the discomfort. Cold plunges are a great way to practice consciously overriding your nervous system's stress response. So with practice and cold plunges, I learned how to like override my body getting goosebumps. Like I would have goosebumps and I could use my breath to like make them go away, or like override my body's response to want to like shake or sh chatter my teeth. Like with practice, you actually can learn how to experience a survival response in your body and calm it down, even while you're still in the stressful environment. I do not recommend cold plunges if you are in like burnout, functional freeze, or shutdown, or chronic depression. Please don't do cold plunges. They will not be good for your body. So here's some tips if you're going to use cold plunges for widening your window of tolerance. So first of all, your nervous system's instinct to cold is to gasp. That's part of a survival response that you can override. So if you hold your breath going into the water so that you have to exhale when you get in rather than inhale, that can kind of mitigate that gasp response. So I mean, like, hold the breath, go in the cold water, hold it as long as you can, and super slow exhale, and then try to breathe normally. Second is to practice muscle relaxation. So, as you know, when you're in a fight flight response, your muscles tense up. Same thing happens when you get in cold, right? Your breathing will, right? And your muscles tense, right? Like you kind of do this in cold water and you don't want to get your belly wet, right? Like you're totally in a nervous system response when you do that. So, when we're in a situation like that, our nervous systems instinctively contract our muscles. Our muscles constrict in cold water too, unless we override that response by noticing where there's contraction in our muscles and intentionally releasing it. Okay, so if you're in like cold water and you notice that like you're doing this with your like being able to stay in that water and invite your body to just like surrender into it instead of trying to avoid it or tense up around it. Can you see how that would help you widen your window of tolerance to stress? Imagine if you're like in a fight with your partner, and instead of doing this and being reactive, you're like, right? This is the practice ground. If you're actually feeling okay, if you're actually in the cold water and you're like, okay, this is a little uncomfortable, but like I'm okay, repeat a mantra. That's when I started using I'm comfortable being uncomfortable. If you're employing the breathing and muscle relaxation that I've mentioned, then you're purposefully putting your nervous system into a calm state, which is the perfect state for a mantra because your nervous system can actually believe what you're saying versus if you're in a panic state and you're like, I'm calm, I'm love, I'm light, right? Like your nervous system not buying that shit. Please do not use cold plunges if you have unregulated low blood pressure or impaired circulation, if you have any kind of condition that makes you hypersensitive or intolerant to cold, if you have used drugs or alcohol, if you have epilepsy, or if you are in a chronic freeze slash shutdown nervous system state. Like if you have untreated hypothyroidism, chronic depression, burnout, constant overwhelm, or chronic fatigue, try the acupressure mat instead. Try a sauna instead. Okay, you can do this exact same thing with the sauna, right? Except instead of cold tolerance, it's heat tolerance, right? And you have to titrate your ability to do that. You might have to start at a lower temperature and then increase to a higher temperature or 5 minutes and then increase to 10 minutes or something like that. So Please use heat instead of cold if you're in a shutdown, burnout, freeze, overwhelm, hypothyroid state. And here's some safety tips. Go with a friend until you're comfortable going alone. If you are plunging in a wild body of water, you will thank me for telling you to wear water shoes because your toes will get numb and nothing feels worse than cold, numb toes on rocks trying to get out of a lake with bare feet. So wear something. Do not take a hot bath or shower to warm you up. Just let your body warm up naturally. Lay in the sun, wrap up in a blanket or clothes, or like do movements. Try to get out of the water before you start shivering, and don't drink alcohol before cold exposure. And finally, my last stressor for you is breath work with holds. If you've watched Thawing the Freeze Response, this is the same breath work as in Thawing the Freeze Response. It is a mobilizing breath, but it can also be a way to increase your stress tolerance because this way of breathing can create sensations that can be uncomfortable. I really like and use the Wim Hof breathing method, which is forced hyperventilation with breath holds. Something that you will feel doing this breath work that pretty much everyone feels is like tingling in your hands, feet, face, arms. People often feel lightheaded or dizzy. And then whenever you do the breath holds, people can always hold their breath for longer than they think they can, because you're just like flooding your body with so much oxygen. Wim Hof says that breathing is the easiest and most instrumental part of the autonomic nervous system to control and navigate. In fact, the way you breathe strongly affects the chemical and physiological activities in your body. So the way you do this breath work is to sit or lie down, take 30 to 40 deep breaths with your eyes closed and all of your focus on your breath, inhaling through the nose or mouth and exhaling through the mouth. After the last exhalation, you can inhale one more time, exhale completely, and stop breathing, and then hold until you feel the natural urge to take a breath. Then you take a big full breath, filling your chest and lungs, hold for 15 seconds, and then resume normal breathing, or you can repeat it. There is actually a demonstration in the Thawing the Freeze Response workshop. So I would actually recommend watching that instead of trying to follow these written directions, because I just take you through the whole practice. Or you can find a video tutorial here, and David will put the link to that in the chat. This is actually a really helpful video because he has a timer and everything on there, so you can like kind of watch and keep up with the time. And you know, if you're starting to feel like you can't hold your breath longer, but you see there's only 5 seconds left, like it kind of helps you stick it out. When you do this type of breath work, the rapid breathing simulates the body's natural stress response and arouses your fight flight nervous system. Think of how you would breathe if you were running from a predator or you just got a massive fright. It would be similar to this forced hyperventilation. There's nothing inherently wrong with manufacturing a stress response through breath work. One of the strengths of the Wim Hof method, when done correctly, is it builds resilience to stress. So when you're in a real stressful situation, like freezing cold water, for example, you're better equipped to deal with it. Studies are finding it may also have other valuable health benefits. So please don't do this type of breath work if you're already in a like highly stressed out, highly mobilized sympathetic nervous system state, or if you don't have the flexibility in your nervous system that it naturally downregulates, or you don't have the skills to downregulate, or if feelings of dizziness, tingling, or lightheadedness is going to trigger anxiety, panic, or health anxiety. Those are all normal things, but I've had some clients with health anxiety who are just like, I can't do that breath work because when I feel those sensations, it's too scary. And that's fine. That's totally fine. That's why I'm giving you options. If this breathing method causes fight flight activation that doesn't resolve on its own, meaning your nervous system doesn't automatically downshift, within a few minutes, you can down-regulate your nervous system with another type of breathing, which is 1-2 breath work. So it's just like if you inhale for 4 seconds, you exhale for 8 seconds. If you inhale for 6 seconds, you exhale for 12 seconds. Your inhale or your exhale is twice as long as your inhale. So that slower exhale breath should signal to your body to put the brake on and down-regulate. So here's how you would do 1-2 breath work. Lay on the ground or a bed, soften your belly, relax your muscles, breathe in through your nose for 4, exhale for 8, or inhale for 3, exhale for 6, inhale for 5, exhale for 10, and practice that for 10 minutes. that this can also be a tool that you use. Like if you just feel like you're in a really big fight flight response, you can go into this type of breathing. So with each of these intentional stressors, you will find that consistent practice and returning to safety during the exercise will translate to being able to tolerate more stress when you're not doing the exercise. That was one of the things that I found to be the most helpful with cold plunges, is that I found myself naturally able to be more resilient to stress the more I did cold plunges. It followed me out of the water, which was really fun. Of course, your own feelings and sensations can also be your intentional stressors. If you have uncomfortable sensations in your body, use that. Just be present with it. Feel it, notice the stories about it. And over time, your ability to be present with and feel your own discomfort will also grow. That is the end of tonight's teaching portion. Let's take another five. Do you guys need a break? Are you ready for Q&A? I'm going to leave it up to you guys. I don't personally need a break, but if you guys need a break, I can take a break.